be afraid of the dark. Just relax and let the darkness fall over you.
Welcome to Afraidish, a podcast where every four episodes we venture into a new state and take a deep dive into the history and paranormal while enjoying some tasty adult beverages. From ghost sightings to hauntings, urban legends and cryptids, let's get weird and afraid-ish together. I'm Paul.
And I'm Ashley.
And welcome to bonus episode 2. In this episode, we'll recap Tennessee and add a little bit more information.
If you say so.
So, this is January 2022.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. We survived the holidays.
Barely.
I'm still busy at work. Still trying to get more than one episode out a month. That didn't happen last month. Got one out early December.
Listen, with the holidays and everything, and now with COVID numbers just beyond just being on the rise, they're just out of control. Sorry, you can hear the dog in the background chewing on his bone. Anyway, most of you know, because most of you work with Paul, it's tough right now. So he's doing his very best to get episodes out. It's just a real shit time for everyone.
Yeah. In a couple of days, we'll get to go to Arkansas, to Eureka Springs, like Yay. You mentioned last time. That's going to be a lot of fun.
I hope so.
I think so. Hopefully this damn snow is going to melt, and at least the roads aren't bad.
Well, I don't know. I mean, probably not after a whole day, but this morning, all I could hear all morning were just cars slipping and sliding around that intersection right by the house. It was terrible.
Really? The roads aren't bad.
They were this morning. Okay. I haven't been out, so I don't know what they're like, but I know this area, and
it's just people don't know how to drive.
No.
All right, anyway, so I think we're just going to get into the recap of the episodes because I have some special highlights after I give some more fun facts about Tennessee.
Ooh, fun!
So in episode 5, or Tennessee episode 1, I talked about the Bell Witch in Adams, Tennessee.
Oh, yes, the Bell Witch.
Yeah, John Bell and his family encountered a witch ghost or ghost witch
or poltergeist.
Poltergeist, yeah. She done some shit and did not like him or his favorite daughter. Remember that?
No, remind me. I mean, I'm vaguely I'm familiar-ish with the Bell Witch, especially after your story, but I don't remember anything about a favorite daughter.
Oh, yeah. In 1804, the family consisting of John and Lucy Bell and their children, Jesse, John Jr., Drury, Benjamin, Esther, Zadok, Elizabeth, a.k.a. Betsy, a.k.a. John's favorite daughter.
Betsy Bell.
Richard Williams and Joel Egbert. They built a house started a farm on 1,000 acres located on the Red River in Robertson County, Tennessee. So,
were they the first people to own that tract of land? Well, first Europeans to own that tract of land?
I'm not sure.
There's a cave there, right?
Yes.
And there's like 6 churches within a 2-mile radius.
You looked at the map around the area and yeah, the cave was right next to the farm close by. And you saw on the maps like 6 churches all named something Bell.
Yeah.
Or Bell something.
Hershey. That is enough.
Literally always the same bone that he chews on when we record.
He likes his bones.
I talked about, you know, who married who and all that stuff. The witch gave them hell pretty much. She basically took care of the mother when she was sick. She talked to Andrew Jackson,
Jax.
They were camping, and she came in, and basically the witch
That's
slayer,
right.
Yeah, scared the shit out of him, and he Andrew Jackson wanted to stay and see what would happen the next night, but the rest of the guys wanted to head back home, so he's like, "All right, let's go."
Listen, I don't know what the actual Bell Witch phenomena was. I don't know what caused it, if it was a deceased person's spirit or if it was a living person playing tricks or whatever. But I will say, if I died, you bet your ass I'd be haunting some people Bell Witch style.
Yeah.
Just for fun.
That would be fun. I mean,
just for shits and giggles. Like, there are some people that I would really like to see shit their pants. I can make that happen.
I talked about how the Bell Witch has been subject to countless modern books, analyses, documentaries, and movies, including the 2006 wide-release motion picture An American Haunting, which was loosely based on the Bell Witch legend.
Oh.
The cave was added to the National Historic Registry in 2008. It is the only original feature from the legend that can still be seen today, largely unchanged from the way the Bell family would have seen it in 1817.
I would hope so. It's a cave. Don't let What's-His-Face get his hands on it.
Who?
The guy that owns Bass Pro. Johnny Morris.
Johnny Morris.
Jesus. He'll blast the shit out of that cave to create his own cave.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah, though numerous eerie events have been reported by visitors to the cave, including the renowned difficulty in taking photographs around the site in the pre-digital age, nothing on the scale of the original haunting centered around the Bell House, long since torn down, has been reported since the early 1800s.
So my theory, since the activity centered around the Bell family and those interacting with the Bell family, it had to be somebody doing funny stuff.
Well, I talked about how it could possibly be Kate Batts.
Yeah!
But like I said, she didn't die until after John Bell died. So,
but if she hated him and was alive, like she could have, I don't know how the cabin was structured, but it was likely elevated off the ground. She could have crawled under there and banged on some
or
shit.
Or like, I don't know if this is possible, but, you know, you could I've heard of, like, people projecting, like, their energy to do shit,
astral maybe. Projection?
Well, that, and, yeah.
Yes, there, in theory, I don't know anyone who has ever actually done this. People like to say that they do, but
there
are people that legit believe that they're dragons and werewolves, too. So, yeah, in theory, you could do something like that, possibly.
Yeah, who knows? Any more questions about the Bell Farm?
No.
All right.
So we should take a trip there sometime.
Yeah, for sure. I want to take.
That'd be fun.
I want to visit all the places we've talked about.
Yeah.
I mean, we have the opportunity to do all the Missouri things.
Pretty much.
Yeah, and then of course we're going to Arkansas to one of the next stories that we're gonna do.
Yay!
So, next, Ashley talked about the Conjun Plantation in Franklin, Tennessee.
Yes.
Built in 1826, it played a massive role in the Franklin's battle during the American Civil War.
Yes, it was the Confederate, mostly, hospital.
It is a red brick federal-style 11-room residence completed in 1826 by prominent politician Randall McGavick.
Mm-hmm.
Using slave labor.
Yep, as most things were back in those days.
Built on limestone foundation where it is said to amplify spiritual energy. So that's a huge reason why, you know, you can feel a lot of energy if you visit there.
Yeah.
So,
And, you know, I, first of all, take this with a grain of salt. I've always considered myself to be sensitive to energy. I always call it the history. Like, I can feel the history, for better or for worse. It just, I can walk into a place and I just feel very buzzy is the best way I can describe it. I felt it at the Alamo too. I felt it. I've been to Carnton Plantation twice. You know, there are just places where you, if you're attuned to that frequency, that energy, you can feel, whether it's spirits, whether it's just energy, who knows, but yeah. It was definitely a very buzzy place. It left a definite mark on me. Now, of course, the history that happened there, absolutely terrible, both the Civil War battle that took place there and everything that happened leading up to that point. I mean, this was a place where European people that whose ancestry comes from Europe, enslaved people from Africa and made a lot of money off the backs of enslaving a whole entire group of people.
Right. And then the Native American massacres just to get land.
Yeah. It's just, I mean, most of America, that's the history of this country, but it happened. Yeah. And it left its mark, and you can feel all of that.
Right. Like you said in your story, in early 1866, 2 acres of the plantation were designated as a final resting place for the Confederate soldiers killed during the battle on the property. Now, I don't remember you saying this, but the initial cost of burial here was $5 per soldier.
Right. Is that the modern equivalent, or was that how much it cost?
I think that back was then. Back then.
So what? That's like a couple hundred bucks.
I don't do math, money. So I have no fucking clue.
Well, what's the what year? 1866.
1866. Yes.
$5.
Yes, and it says the cost entirely covered by the citizens of Franklin within 18 months. The entirety of the battle and its following events were a concerning depiction of patriotism and familial selflessness.
Mm. Oh my God.
What?
It was still only $85.52 approximately in today's money.
That's not bad.
Could you imagine burying somebody for $85?
Oh my God. What is it now, like,
well, $20,000?
Yeah. It's freaking crazy.
I'm not going to get in on that soapbox. Yeah. I'm... Jesus.
It's a monopoly.
I've been watching Ask a Mortician on YouTube, and I've learned things.
Yeah, so it talks more about the history of it. Like 1,700 Confederate soldiers were buried here, making this the largest Confederate graveyard in the South, entire South, like you said mm-hmm. before. A ghost of a young girl has been seen in the home's kitchen, who is said to have been murdered before the war by a jealous suitor whom she rejected.
That's interesting, considering the kitchen doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah.
It was destroyed in a tornado in the 90s.
Maybe.
Maybe before the tornado?
Or the spot where it would be. I don't know.
Right off the side of the house. I mean, you could still see the kitchen. Yeah. The kitchen door still exists. It's just the kitchen was destroyed during a tornado in the 90s.
This article says she's still said to still sweep the floors at dusk. The spirits here enjoy the autumn months most, probably due to the summer heat pushing anyone around indoors or into the shade.
Or possibly because as we move into autumn, we move closer towards Halloween and the traditional pre-Christian idea of the thinning veil, the spirit world and the human world becoming less separate.
Yeah. At dusk, during October, visitors may see the ghost of a woman floating effortlessly across the back porch, or even the spirits of fallen soldiers out on the home surrounding fields.
Yes. I talked about one visitor witnessed what he thought were reenactors
ride up
on horses and then like fucking disappear right before his eyes.
Yeah. So they threw up their hats and then everybody disappeared. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sometimes you can hear gunshots.
That's probably one of my favorite ghost stories. That is pretty cool. Yeah.
I mean, according to, and I've read about that particular interaction multiple times, and according to the guy, he legit thought he was talking to reenactors and that they were just in character, and they just disappeared. And
a Confederate general has also been reported pacing the front bottom porch during the fall as well.
The front bottom porch or the back porch? Because the back porch is where everything happened.
It says pacing the front bottom porch.
Well, I don't know. You can't pace a portico.
So is there like a bottom porch and then like a balcony above
on the
it?
Back?
The back?
On the back of the back of the house is the one with the porch spans the entire length of
maybe
the house.
Maybe that's what they mean.
And it's upper and lower story. The front has just a very small portico, just like a when you think of a porch on a modern house, it's just like a little spot in front of the door.
Either way, there's a Confederate general who walks around there.
Okay.
A mischievous spirit is reported here most often, and when the home's curator heard some strange noises coming from the enclosed back porch, she went to investigate. She found two panes of glass taken down from a shelf and placed against the back door. She believes this sly spirit is that of the murdered young girl. The floating head of the cook, who worked for the family during the Civil War, has also been spotted floating through the hallway and kitchen areas. She can be heard bustling around the kitchen, going about her various duties, even in the afterlife.
Where are you getting this information from?
NashvilleGhosts.com.
And where are they getting this information from?
Who knows?
There's no kitchen. The porch, the back porch is not enclosed.
Am I reading about the wrong place?
Are you reading about the Carter House?
Carnton Plantation.
Yeah, okay.
All right, well.
It just goes to show you can't believe everything you read on the internet. That's because true. People make shit up for clicks. Look at BuzzFeed. BuzzFeed is a dumpster fire.
I don't know. There are a lot of ghosts there. Either way, it's pretty haunted.
Yes, I agree with that sentiment.
With ghostly soldiers, people who've lived there, slaves, pretty much anyone who's died in that area.
Yeah. I will say, when I visited there, at the time, I don't remember the exact time of year that I went either time. It may have been late spring-ish, possibly summer. One time that I went, like I said, I've been there twice, and they both when I was in high school. One time when I went, they were having some flooding issues, and there are, or were, at the time, this was in fucking 2005, there were still slaves' quarters that were still standing.
Yeah.
But they're down kind of down a hill.
Yeah.
And there was flooding in the area, so you couldn't go down there. But I just remember feeling like I wanted to go down there so bad.
Right.
And I don't know if it was psychological, them saying, well, you can't go down there.
Yeah.
Or if it was like something pulling me down there. I wanted to go down there so badly. Just the feeling of sadness just emanating up from those two little shacks. It's just really chilling and heartbreaking.
Yeah. I bet that feeling pretty much emanates with any plantation that everything like that basically happened. We'll leave this story with a short quote by the late, great B.B. King. I was born on a plantation, and things weren't so good. We didn't have any money. I never thought of the word poor till I got to be a man. But when you live in a house that you can always peek out of and see what kind of day it is, you're not doing so well, and your restroom is not inside the house. So, that's pretty wild.
Yeah.
Back then, he was pretty old. He basically lived in a place like that and had an outhouse, no indoor plumbing.
At the time that he was quoting this, or
when he was
remembering his childhood on a plantation?
His childhood on a plantation, because he said it was born on a plantation and things weren't so good.
Okay.
So. All right. In episode 6, I talked about Tennessee State Prison, Ashley's favorite long-ass story. So, yeah, it had a long history.
Mm-hmm.
And I talked about, I don't even know, it's so much history. And basically, you can't go there, you can't trespass, but some people have. I wrote a little...
I mean, it's a hazard.
Yes.
To trespass there.
Yeah. I wrote a little ghost story, and Ashley was quiet because she was expecting something worse.
Yeah. you talked it up.
Yeah.
And I was expecting, like...
Because I feel like I'm a terrible writer, so I thought it was better than it was.
I didn't think it was bad. No, I just was expecting... Oh, you thought it was scarier than
what it
ended up being. Well, I was happy that it wasn't any worse than it was.
So, yeah, people have broken in to the prison, experience clanking noises from the cell bars at the other end of the corridor. When they walk down to check the noise, there's nothing there.
Of course.
Gut-wrenching screams and people yelling can be heard from the cells and from the room where the electric chair is in.
Mm-hmm.
Disembodied footsteps and voices echo the halls. And that's when I get into the little story. Should I tell it or just skip it?
I mean, if they want to hear it, they can go back and listen to that episode.
Yeah, go back to episode 6. Yeah, and then I talked about how a massive tornado destroyed the wall and radio tower.
Basically rendered it a safety hazard to be on the premises.
And the only visual document left is a drone video that I talked about.
Yeah, I remember you showing me that.
Yeah, that was pretty cool. And then Ashley talked about the Carter House.
Which is also in Franklin, Tennessee.
Which is in Franklin.
Just a little bit down the road from Carnton Plantation.
Right. All right. Carter House had a few hauntings.
Mm-hmm. One was really fun. I believe it was a Yelp or TripAdvisor review where this person... I believe, I'm just going off my memory, I believe they were traveling with a friend or a few friends. They drove up to the Carter House. I think it was on Halloween.
Oh, yeah.
They were looking for some spooks.
Yeah.
And there were some people that they thought were period actors gathered around a bonfire.
Yeah, they said they were...
They spoke to these reenactors. Tour guides.
Yeah.
Had like a fairly lengthy, detailed conversation. Directions were given,
right?
And to some, I think it was like, go to this place. This is a fun place to go to on Halloween.
Yeah, Carnton Plantation.
Was it?
Yeah, they sent them.
Okay.
If you want any more spooks, go to Carnton Plantation and.
Okay. Well, they get in their car and they drive out the driveway and then turn back around and pull back in, I guess, to ask another question.
Yeah.
And like there was no sign of any fire ever.
Yeah.
Having been like, there were no smoldering ashes, like somebody poured water on a fire or anything. There was no sign that anyone had been around.
Right. Yeah, that was pretty cool.
That was really cool. And then, you know, the typical wartime.
Yeah.
Basically, plantation hauntings, enslaved peoples.
Yeah.
Just, you know, random ghosties.
Yeah, like witnesses have described apparitions, a statue jumping up and down.
Oh.
Tugging at their clothing.
Yes.
And unexplained voices.
Yes. I believe the upstairs bedroom where one of the sons died from his battle wounds. Is a particular hotspot, if I'm remembering correctly.
I think so.
And then was there something to do with a body in a cellar at this house, or was that something else?
I don't know. Would be nice if you kept your notes, but...
Well, I have them. I just don't know what notebook they're in, and I'm not going to flip through 15 different notebooks to find them. Because ADHD is a bitch, and organization is not... doesn't exist.
Right. And okay, in episode 7, I talked about a few urban legends.
Oh yeah.
That would be Skin Tom. About how he was such a slut that he met up with a married woman. They went to a lover's lane, and the husband told the wife that he was going on a work trip or something, and he went to the lover's lane, found him, pulled Tom out of the car, stabbed his wife in the stomach or something, and took Tom into the woods and skinned him alive, and came back and just drove to the police station. Cops got there, found the wife still alive, and they looked for Tom, only found his skin hanging in a tree.
Ew.
So that's Skin Tom. Also, Tom hangs around the lover's lanes waiting for cheaters to teach them a lesson with the same hunting knife he was skinned with. So basically that was to teach teens not to go to lover's lanes and do that stuff. And my next episode was The Legend of Werewolf Springs. It was about a circus train that derailed through Dixon County. It derailed in Burns, which is southeast of Dixon.
Okay.
And some of the animals escaped. Among them were a pair of half-human, half-wolf creatures who were exhibited under the moniker the Wolfmen of Borneo. The circus crew caught all the escaped animals except for the Wolfmen.
Of course.
I talked about how two travelers on a nearby road were walking and they found themselves being stalked by the creatures. There's a landowner and a hired hand. They ran and separated, trying to outrun the creature, but the creature caught up with the hired hand, and the landowner had to hear the hired hand being tortured. And
of course it couldn't be the landowner that got caught right. up with.
So the hired hand's body was never located. A mob of locals, basically with pitchfork and torches, formed. All right, and then I talked a little bit about the history of the area. I said the railroad tracks where the train derailed still run through original course along the park's southern edge. Several train derailments were on the stretch of line, though none specifically involved a circus train, so they're not really sure if that actually happened or not. So
I'm going to say no. I'm going to say a big old fat no.
And that's why it's an urban legend.
Exactly.
And Ashley talked about the Gaylord Opryland Resort and Convention Center in Nashville.
Yeah.
And do you have any specifics or hauntings for that one?
I honestly don't remember too many of the specific hauntings off the top of my head. That one was kind of, even though it's purported to be super haunted, it's really hard to find. I remember having trouble finding specific stories about that specific hotel. A lot of the same ghosts, you know, a lady in white or a lady in black or a lady in blue, depending on who sees her and who talks or who retells the story. Supposedly, was it supposed to be Sarah or Carrie McGavick? One of them haunts the hotel for some reason.
I think so.
Yeah, that. So that one was, that was more about the history and less about the hauntings for me.
Right.
That's another location that I've actually physically been to. It's kind of insane. If you've if you've ever been to it, you would understand. It's a big old thing.
Yeah.
They've got multiple indoor gardens, indoor towns, really.
And that's the one with the river that was...
There's a river. Yeah. There's like 50,000 different species of plants or something.
That's crazy.
Ridiculous like that. Rich white people doing what rich white people do.
Yeah.
Also, bringing nature indoors.
There was one more story that I forgot about called the White Bluff Screamer that I did.
Oh.
And there was a family that moved to the holler in White Bluff. The father and mother, seven children, seemed happy until the nights descended and they began to hear ear-shattering screams from the forest. I remember when the father just had it, and he's grabbed his rifle, ran into the forest where he heard the screams, and then he turns around and hears the screams from his house and goes back to the house, and that's where he found his family. Their bodies were torn apart. In one version, he sees a woman wrapped in white mist inside the home who let out a piercing shriek and then vanished.
Huh.
So that...
spooky.
And then people say that it might be a banshee.
Banshees foretell death. They don't cause it.
I don't know.
I've never, ever, ever... First of all, banshees are Celtic folklore. What the fuck are they doing in America?
Right.
Second of all, I've never, ever, ever, ever heard a story about a banshee tearing people from limb to limb.
I don't. It's an urban legend.
So. Yes, I'm aware.
In episode 8, I talked about the Union Station Hotel in Nashville.
Yeah.
That was pretty cool. Oh, and we had a special ad.
Oh, yes, we did.
ST's Tannery and Tannery Accessories.
I never did get that handbag.
So, if you want to hear that, Ashley laughs through the whole thing because she figured out what was going on. But it was pretty funny.
It was very funny.
The Union Station resembled a modern-day castle. It was constructed on August 1st, 1898. I remember it had a couple of alligator ponds at one time.
Oh, yeah.
That was pretty cool. And it was purchased by different companies at different times.
As they do.
Yes.
I think I remember the Gaylord Opryland Hotel. It has been like sold and purchased like 30 yeah. or something times. It's ridiculous.
The hauntings for this. During World War II, 20-year-old Abigail said goodbye to her beau at the Union Station before he left for France. While standing at the platform, she promised she would be waiting for him in the same spot when the war was over. Basically, she went back. He wasn't there. She was told that he died.
Aww.
And then she jumped off onto the train tracks.
Aww.
And basically, a woman having a smoke break witnessed a woman jumping. The woman was dressed in vintage clothing. The woman went over and looked. The lady was gone. She only saw the soldier down there walking around. And it said that when the woman, it's like a
time loop.
Time loop, yeah. So every time she jumps, the soldiers down there, they miss each other by a few seconds. So that's pretty wild.
I mean, they're ghosts. How do they keep missing each other?
I don't know. And room 711 is haunted.
711.
Yep. People describe hearing what sounds like heavy furniture dragged above the room, especially during early hours of the morning. Some have even felt sudden, unexplained drops in the room's temperature and feeling like they are not alone.
Hmm.
Yeah, that's pretty much it.
Yeah.
And Ashley talked about the Ryman Auditorium.
Yes.
Yes. And that was pretty cool.
Yeah. I mean, long, long history. Moved a couple times to finally...
Yeah, he's... forgot his first name, but Ryman, born-again Christian, basically.
Yes, it was founded as a tabernacle.
Yeah,
a
tabernacle, yeah.
And then it just kind of slowly evolved into where they would have Christian performers come perform at their... what were they? Revivals.
Right.
And then... I think to pay off some debt or something, they started renting it out to other performers, but the original owner didn't like it because it was not glorifying to God.
Yeah.
And he threw a hissy fit about that, but
yeah. And then he died. Cursed, and because basically the musicians that performed there have died like random deaths. I guess.
I mean, people die.
Well, yeah, but...
And not everybody that's ever performed at the Ryman has has died.
This is supposed, but...
But, I mean, eventually everyone that has performed at the Ryman will eventually die.
It's the curse. All right. Those are the recaps. Sorry for rushing that, but there's a lot more. Here's some extra facts about the Volunteer State. Number one, the earliest version of the name that became Tennessee was recorded in 1567 by Spanish explorer Captain Juan Pardo. While traveling from South Carolina, he passed an American Indian village known as Tenasque. The actual word Tennessee comes from the Cherokee Native American word Tanasi. That means the meeting place.
Hmm.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. Number two, Tennessee was entered into the Union on June 1st, 1796. Number three, Reelfoot Lake is considered the turtle capital of the world.
Oh, I'm guessing freshwater turtles.
Yes. Number four, the Manhattan Project was based in Oak Ridge, where secret research for the creation of the atomic bomb took place. The city was known as the Secret City or Atomic City. Many of the workers didn't even realize they were helping to develop the bomb.
Oh.
That's pretty wild. Number five, the state bird is the mockingbird. The state animal is the raccoon.
Oh. Why?
I put that in there because I just thought that was pretty interesting.
Like, who's like, oh, we like this garbage bandit so much that we're going to make it our state animal.
Right.
First of all. Fuck raccoons.
Yeah.
Second of all, fuck possums.
Yep. Number six, Wilma Rudolph, an African-American sprinter from Tennessee, won three gold medals in the 1960 Olympic Games in track and field. She suffered from several childhood illnesses, including pneumonia, scarlet fever, and polio at the age of five. However, with her strong determination and the support of the doctors and her family, she was able to walk unassisted once again and compete and win medals in the Olympics.
Mm.
So just another amazing feat from an African-American woman. And number seven, the Lost Sea in Sweetwater, Tennessee is the largest underground lake in America.
Wow.
Number eight, the Great Smoky Mountains are known as the salamander capital of the world. At least 30 species of salamanders live in the park.
I could live my whole life without learning that fact.
Number nine, there's a giant Renaissance-style castle in Arrington. Unfortunately, it's only open to visitors during the Renaissance Festival.
Oh, well, maybe we should go to the Renaissance Festival.
Yeah. Number 10, Nashville hosts the Full Moon Tattoo and Horror Festival on an annual basis, and a visit will give you the chance to meet some of your favorite niche actors and experience a horror event unlike any other.
I would go for the tattoos.
That sounds pretty fun.
Not a big fan of horror, which I understand is an ironic statement considering I'm participating in a paranormal podcast.
Yeah.
And also other things I do in my spare time. I don't mind ghosties. I don't like horror, especially modern horror. I could go on a whole rant about it, and I won't.
Yep. All right. Here are some famous people from Tennessee. Morgan Freeman, born June 1st, 1937 in Memphis. Number two, Anna Mae Bullock, or Tina Turner, as you know her. Born November 26, 1939 in Nutbush, Tennessee. Number three, the late Aretha Franklin, born March 25th, 1942 in Memphis. Died August 16th, 2018 at age 76.
Wow.
Quentin Tarantino, born March 27th, 1963 in Knoxville.
Wow.
Yeah. Johnny Knoxville, born March 11th, 1971. Guess where he was born?
Tallahassee. Knoxville.
Knoxville, yeah. Number six, Kathy Bates, an amazing actress. Born June 28th, 1948 in Memphis.
Ah.
Number seven, Sarah Ophelia Colley Cannon, a.k.a. Minnie Pearl. Okay. Apparently, Ashley has never heard of Minnie Pearl.
No, that sounds familiar, but I'm having a hard time.
Okay. She was born October 25th, 1912 in Centerville, Tennessee. She died March 4th, 1996 at age 83. She was a country comedian who appeared at the Grand Ole Opry more than 50 years.
That's how I know her name was from my research on the Grand Ole Opry. I don't know who she is, but I was like, I know that name. How do I know that name?
So she performed from 1940 to 1991. And on the television show Hee Haw from 69 to 91.
Hmm.
Okay, so the last three, in my opinion, are three of very many historic icons born in Tennessee. Since this podcast is also a history podcast, I've decided to give a little more info about these last three amazing women. Dolly Parton. Born January 19th, 1946 in Locust Ridge, Tennessee. Dolly Parton is a woman with multiple talents. She is a noted...
She's a woman and she's talented? I'm kidding. I'm sorry.
She is a noted singer, lyricist, author, actress, and businesswoman. She is also known for her charitable work. She began her career at the young age of 13. Although she initially gained fame... as a lyricist, she later attained success in other fields as well. She's best known for country music and is a star in this genre. She has written and put together more than 3,000 songs in the course of her career that has exceeded six decades and has won many accolades such as the Grammy Awards, Country Music Association Awards, and American Music Awards, along with nominated for the Oscar Awards twice. Dolly Parton held the record of having received the maximum number of Grammy Award nominations of 46 till 2013.
Wow.
That's crazy.
Who surpassed her? Don't know. I don't care.
Other than singing, she has been trained to play the musical instruments, piano, banjo, and guitar.
Aww.
She publicly supports LGBTQ equality and is identified as a gay icon by the LGBTQ community.
Yes, she is.
Dolly Parton is known to have English, Irish, German, and Scottish ancestry. In her early life, she was the fourth of 12 children born to Robert Lee Parton, a farmer and construction laborer, and Avy Lee. She later described her family to be economically backward. Not sure what that meant.
Poor.
For, yeah. Her family was inclined towards music and she took up singing from her mother. She credits her uncle Bill Owens for supporting her in taking music as a career at a young age. After graduating from high school in 1964, she moved to Nashville to pursue her career in music. She began her professional performances at age 10 through television and radio shows in Knoxville. Later, her career began flourishing in 67. When she partnered with entertainer Porter Wagoner for the Porter Wagoner Show, this partnership also helped her in receiving a musical contract from RCA Records.
Are you saying Wagoner?
Wagoner.
Is it not Wagner?
Well, it's W-A-G-O-N-E-R.
Maybe I'm wrong, but I would pronounce that as Wagner, not Wagoner.
Oh, well, Wagoner.
Wagoner. That feels hard on my tongue.
Same thing. RCA Records released her first single as a duet partner with Porter Wagoner, a cover of Tom Paxton's song, The Last Thing on My Mind, which was released in 1967 and reached the country's top 10 in early 1968. The following 6 years witnessed an unbreakable top 10 singles from this partnership. In 1971, Dolly Parton earned her first number one country singles hit with the song Joshua. She had many more hits, singles, and duets in the following years, which include songs like Coat of Many Colors, Burning the Midnight Oil, Touch Your Woman, and The Right Combination. In 1973, Dolly Parton had the biggest hit until then with the single Jolene, which is an amazing song, by the way. The following year, she released I Will Always Love You, a country chart topper song that went on to be one of her signature songs. In 1974, she had three country chart toppers to her credit, Jolene, I will always love you, and love is like a butterfly. Wanting to pursue her dream of a solo career, Dolly Parton made the decision to end a partnership with Porter Wagoner around this time. However, they remained on good terms, and he continued to assist Dolly with her records. They continued to work on duet albums, and their final work was in 1975 with Say Forever You'll Be Mine. Dolly Parton attempted to enhance her visibility by shifting from country music to pop, and in the year 1976, she began her association with talent manager Sandy Galling, who went on to be her personal manager for the next 25 years.
Wow.
The same year, she released her album, All I Can Do. However, the first few albums did not make it to the top of the charts, though they were received fairly well. In 1977, she released her first crossover number, Here You Come Again, which topped both pop and country music charts. She received her first Grammy Award for this performance in 1978. During the 2 years that followed, Dolly Parton continued to give hit numbers that topped country music charts as well. She made multiple television appearances during this time through interviews and hosting shows. In 1980, her popularity increased yet again with multiple hit performances that included Starting Over Again, Old Flames Can't Hold a Candle to You, and 9 to 5.
Working 9 to 5.
She had also acted in the comedy feature film 9 to 5 in 1980. The theme song of this film became the number one in adult contemporary, pop, and country music charts at the same time in 1981.
Wow!
That's insane. Dolly was the only musician to have such a record. After the success of her acting debut, she acted in quite a few movies, such as Best Little Whorehouse in Texas, which is pretty funny, Rhinestone in 1984, Steel Magnolias in 1989.
Listen, you want to see me cry? There's two movies that are guaranteed to have me bawling no matter that how happy I am before I start watching them. Steel Magnolias is one of them.
I did not know that.
I will weep. The other one is Artificial Intelligence.
Oh my goodness.
like the whole second half of that movie, just...
Oh my gosh.
It's terrible. Yeah. It's so bad.
Not bad in a bad, but bad in an emotional... No,
bad and like, yeah, like the ugly, the Kim Kardashian ugly crying.
Yeah. And Straight Talk in 1992, and a few television shows. In 1986, Dolly Parton opened a theme park by the name Dollywood in Tennessee.
Isn't there a Dollywood in Branson now?
I'm not sure.
I'm pretty sure.
I don't know. The amusement park is a popular travel destination even today. The mid-80s were a period when Dolly Parton was still doing relatively well in music with good record sales. However, her contract with RCA Records ended.
Oh, there's a Dolly Parton stampede in Branson. Sorry, yeah. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
That's the big restaurant and shows and stuff, yeah.
Yeah, I've never been. I would go to that.
Yeah, that sounds fun.
I would probably prefer Medieval Times, but we don't have a Medieval Times, yeah. So I would go to Dolly Parton.
All right. Anyways, her contract with RCA Records ended during the same time, after which she signed a contract with Columbia Records in 1987.
Hmm.
In the same year, she released the album Trio along with songwriter and singer Amy Lou Harris and singer Linda Ronstadt, which became a hit and earned much critical acclaim. Dolly Parton continued to strive towards success in pop music with the album Rainbow. Later, she concentrated on country music and produced number one hits like Yellow Roses and Why'd You Come In Here Looking Like That. Dolly Parton received much commercial success after renowned singer Whitney Houston recorded her song I Will Always Love You for the feature film The Bodyguard in 1992. The song as well as the album was a massive hit. In 1993, her album Slow Dancing with the Moon won much critical acclaim. In the same year, the songwriters of her song The Day I Fall in Love, which was featured in the movie Beethoven's Second, won an Academy Award nomination for Best Original Song. Until the late 1990s, her songs were appreciated and maintained their uniqueness. Beginning in 1999, she recorded a series of albums inspired by bluegrass music, a type of American country music. She made four albums, The Grass is Blue in 99, Little Sparrow, 2001, Halos and Horns, 2002, and Those Were the Days in 2005. In 2005, she also wrote the song Traveling Through for the feature film Trans America, for which she was nominated for an Academy Award that year. Since then, she has been active through appearances on musical shows, releasing her own song collections, and so on. In 2013, she collaborated with Kenny Rogers, rest in peace, for a musical album, You Can't Make Old Friends. And in 2014, she released her 42nd album, Blue Smoke.
42nd
album. Okay. The next person I'd like to highlight is Mary Fields. Born into slavery around 1832, after the Civil War ended, she was emancipated and found work as a chambermaid on board the Robert E. Lee, a Mississippi River steamboat. There she encountered Judge Edmund Dunn and ultimately worked in his household as a servant. After Dunn's wife died, he sent Fields and his late wife's five children to live with his sister, Mother Mary Amadeus, in Toledo, Ohio, where she was Mother Superior of an Ursuline convent. Yeah. In 1884, Mother Amadeus was sent to Montana.
How is that spelled?
A-M-A-D-E-U-S.
Amadeus?
Amadeus. Oh, Amadeus. Mother Amadeus was sent to Montana Territory to establish a school for Native American girls at St. Peter's Mission, west of Cascade. What?
Fucking boarding schools.
I know.
Or I should say residential schools, because those are not boarding schools. Those are fucking a whole thing.
Learning that Amadeus was stricken with pneumonia, Fields hurried to Montana to nurse her back to health. Amadeus recovered and Fields stayed at St. Peter's, relegated multiple charges regarded as men's work at the time, such as maintenance, repairs, fetching supplies, laundry, gardening, hauling freight, growing vegetables, tending chickens, and repairing buildings, and eventually became the forewoman.
Oh.
The Native Americans called Fields White Crow because she acts like a white person but has black skin. Life in a nunnery was placid, but Fields' hardy temperament and habitual profanity made the religious community uncomfortable. In 1894, after several complaints and an incident with a disgruntled male subordinate that involved gunplay, the bishop barred her from the convent and Fields moved to Cascade, where she opened a tavern but waned due to allowing the cash poor to dine for free. It closed due to bankruptcy about 10 months later. By 1895, at 60 years old, Fields secured a job as a star route carrier, which used a stagecoach to deliver mail in the unforgiving weather and rocky terrain of Montana. With the help of nearby Ursuline nuns, who relied on Mary for help at their mission. So this is why I highlighted her. This made her the first African-American woman to work for the U.S. Postal Service. True to her fearless demeanor, she carried multiple firearms, mostly a notable 38 Smith & Wesson, under her apron to protect herself and the mail from wolves, thieves, and bandits driving the route with horses and a mule named Moses.
Aww.
She never missed a day, and her reliability earned her the nickname Stagecoach Mary, due to her preferred mode of transportation. If the snow was too deep for her horses, Fields delivered the mail on snowshoes, carrying the sacks on her shoulders.
Oh my god.
She was a respected public figure in Cascade, and the town closed its schools to celebrate her birthday each year.
Aww.
That's so cool.
Alright, so next time I hear you complain about the fucking weather,
yeah,
be grateful you don't have to deliver your mail in snowshoes.
Yeah.
Bitch.
When Montana passed a law forbidding women to enter saloons, the mayor of Cascade granted her an exemption. So she got to go in.
Aww.
In 1903, at age 71, Fields retired from Star Route mail carrier service. The townspeople's adoration for Fields was evident when her home was rebuilt by volunteers after it caught fire in 1912.
Aww.
She continued to babysit many Cascade children and owned and operated a laundry service from her home. Fields died in 1914 at Columbus Hospital in Great Falls, and her funeral was one of the largest the town had ever seen. She was buried outside Cascade, Montana.
Aww.
And one more, and then we're done.
Okay.
The last one I think is amazing too. Not the most amazing, but she's pretty amazing. The Queen of Pinups, Miss Betty Page.
Oh, yeah.
Born April 22nd, 1923 in Nashville. She died December 11th, 2008 at the age of 85.
Wow.
Betty Page was a cultural icon in the 1950s who forwarded an air of mystical mystery around her. Popularly referred to as the Queen of Pinups, she was famous for her free-spirited demeanor and unabashed sensuality. Her trademark short bangs, natural jet black hair, and sparkling blue eyes, and voluptuous figure were and still are influential to artists. She started her career as a pinup model and soon reached the height of success due to her no-inhibition personality and dare-to-bear attitude.
She was like the first bondage pinup, wasn't she? Like, she was the first.
I believe so. Yeah, she wasn't afraid to do anything except for, like, I'll get into it, but yeah. She became a household name after the launch of her picture as the Playboy Playmate of the Month in the January 1955 issue of Playboy. What made her different from the rest was that, unlike other pinup models whose careers lasted for just a couple of months, she was in demand for years. She frequently posed nude but never made appearances in explicitly sexual scenes.
Hmm.
However, the escalating career faced a somewhat back gear when Page became a born-again Christian. She turned to evangelic activities, vanishing from the public eye and working to serve at various missionaries. She regained fame in the 1980s after resurgence of her photographs from her shoots in the 1950s.
Interesting.
Betty Mae Page was born to Walter Roy Page and Edna Mae Pirtle. She was the second of six children born to the couple. Page's parents divorced when she was 10 years old, and her mother worked two jobs, one as a hairdresser during the day and the other washing laundry at night. Unable to care for her children, Edna placed Page at age 10 and her two sisters in a Protestant orphanage for a year. Their father remained in the area at one point, renting a basement room from the cash-strapped Edna. Page said he began sexually molesting her when she was 13. She eventually got him sent to prison,
mm-hmm.
which... good for her.
Yeah.
During her growing up years, she, along with her siblings, imitated her favorite star by trying on different makeup and hairstyles. These fun pastime acts eventually proved useful for her in her modeling career later on. Academically, she attained her formal education from Hume Goff High School, where she was voted most likely to succeed.
Oh.
She graduated as a salutatorian with a scholarship in June 1940. Scholastically proficient, she enrolled at George Peabody College, intending to take up a teaching profession.
Oh.
It was while studying at the college that she first took to studying acting with the hope of becoming an actor. Meanwhile, she secured a job for herself as a typist for author Alfred Leland Crabb. In 1943, she married her classmate Billy Neal. The marriage did not work out for the long, and the two separated with her filing for divorce in 1947. Before that, she graduated from college with a Bachelor of Arts degree in 1944. Following her graduation, she briefly worked in San Francisco before moving to Haiti. In 1949, she finally relocated to New York City to launch herself as an actress. However, to support herself financially, she worked as a secretary. It was 1950 that she chanced upon meeting Jerry Tibbs and aspiring photographer who professionally was a police officer, and Tibbs clicked various snaps for her, thus coming up with her first pinup portfolio. Soon she became a member of the camera club, mostly formed to skirt the restrictions caused by photography. She started her glam career by posing as the model for Cass Carr. Her no-inhibition personality and dare-to-bear attitude made her a hit among the photographers and the camera club. She soon gained popularity in the erotic photography industry and became the cover girl for various men's magazines, including Wink, Titter, Eiffel, and Beauty Parade. Never heard of any one of them. From 1952 to 1957, she served as the model for Irving Claw, who snapped her for mail-order photographs and short black and white 8mm and 16mm specialty films. In her shoots, she depicted various moods and scenarios for abduction, domination, and slave training. She soon became the top pinup model in New York.
Yeah, when you're willing to do anything.
Yeah, almost anything. Meanwhile, in 1953, she took up acting classes in the Herbert Berghoff Studio. Following this, she made guest appearances on stage and television. She even starred in an off-Broadway production. The following year, while vacationing, she first met aspiring photographer Bunny Yeager. She finally agreed to shoot with him. The place of the shoot was iconic and extraordinary, and so were the photographs, which went to become her most celebrated pictures ever. Keeping with the theme of the location, which was a wildlife park, Yeager shot her in a leopard costume.
I literally just scrolled across that picture.
Oh my goodness, that is so cool. It's awesome. Yeager shot her in a leopard costume and nude shots with a pair of cheetahs. Most of the outfit for her shoot with Yeager was designed by her. Yeah, Betty designed pretty much all of her outfits for her shoots. Wow. Which is pretty amazing.
Yeah.
After the shoot, Yeager sent the photographs to Playboy founder Hugh Hefner, who selected one of the pictures as the Playmate of the Month centerfold for the January 1955 issue. In 1958, she married Armand Walterson. That marriage only lasted for 5 years. It was a service she attended at the Key West Baptist Church that proved to be a turning point in the life of this ultra-glamorous pinup model. She experienced a religious inclination and is said to have been a born-again Christian. She soon started attending Bible colleges. She studied at Bible Institute of Los Angeles, Multnomah School of the Bible, and Bible Town, a Christian retreat in Boca Raton, Florida. It was due to her being a divorcee that she could not become a Christian missionary. However, this did not deter her from taking up religious activities as she started working for various Christian organizations.
It was because she was a divorcee that she couldn't become a missionary. If she hadn't been a divorcee, do you think they would have let her become a missionary in spite of the photographs, or would they have used that as an excuse not to let her be a missionary?
They probably would have used that as an excuse. In 1963, she settled in Nashville and took up full-time duties with Reverend Billy Graham. Her remarriage with her first husband gave her admission to take up missionary work. In 1979, she relocated to South Carolina. However, therein she was diagnosed with schizophrenia. For 8 years, she was under state supervision at Patton State Hospital and was finally released in 1992. Meanwhile, in the world of modeling, her name started to resonate with popularity and admiration as people reckoned her as the icon of erotica of the bygone era. Her name was featured in the list of artists who once famous had vanished from the public eye. There were books written about her and photo books launched that contained her photographs from the shoots carried out between the 1950s and 60s. Several artists started painting her images, and she became the cover face for Italian jean manufacturer Fiorucci. I'm guessing that's how you say it. What's more, comic book artist Dave Steven had his female love interest based on her. In 1987, Greg Theakston started a fanzine that gave readers a glimpse of the life of her and her camera club days. No sooner did she gain a cult star status with women imitating her style and signature looks, men candidly eyeing her and fans awaiting her. The media caught on to this hype and started writing articles on her. In 1993, after more than a decade-long self-hiatus, she zoomed back on television giving interviews to various media organizations. She was clueless as to what caused the resurgence of her popularity. Shortly thereafter, she started the second inning of her life. She influenced the titular characters of various magazines and comic books. In 1996, she came up with an autobiography, Betty Page, The Life of a Pinup Legend, which gave a detailed report of her life and her days in obscurity. The same year, she gave a one-on-one interview for the NBC Morning Magazine program, Real Life, in which she reminisced her career and gave anecdotes about her personal life. She even showed photographs from her collection. Her last interview was with E! True Hollywood Story, in which the location of the interview and her face were blackened out on her request and not revealed. On December 6, 2008, she suffered a major stroke and was hospitalized in critical condition. She was in a coma and was taken off life support. On December 11, 2008, Betty Page breathed her last breath and was interred at Westwood Village Memorial Park Cemetery in Los Angeles, California, which is the same cemetery where another American icon was placed in an above-ground crypt. Can you guess who?
Marilyn Monroe.
Marilyn Monroe. So that was my highlights of famous women.
Wow.
Who have succeeded in life. So I hope everyone liked it. I know it was kind of long.
Kinda.
It's fine.
No offense. I'm just tired.
I know. I get it. I really hope everybody liked it. I hope you liked how I did it. I know I skimmed through the recaps. I'm mostly interested in the extra stuff that I did, so
yeah,
hopefully you are too.
That was fun. I enjoyed hearing about, like, the famous people.
So yeah, I kind of figured, like, during these bonus episodes, I would highlight, like, different famous people that have, you know,
yeah,
done a lot, and I like it a lot.
Yeah, I will say Tennessee kind of has some regrets from that series, because there was so much more that we could have talked about.
There's a lot more for each state that we could do.
I mean, only doing 4 episodes a
state.
I still feel like there's still so much more in our own state, Missouri, that we could talk about.
There's a ton. I mean, I don't know what else we could do. I mean, we could do more episodes per state, but I feel
then,
like
we don't do enough episodes anyway.
I know. We'll get there. I mean,
we will
go back around once we've hit every state, because we could go back
around.
At the rate
we're going, it's gonna take us 10 years.
I know. I'm sorry.
It's okay. It's half your fault, half my fault. Mostly my fault. This time it was your fault.
Yes.
Well, it was work's fault and COVID's fault. And
that's all right. We'll make it work. At least we're getting something out every month.
For the record, he hasn't had COVID. It's just that everyone at his work has COVID right now. So he's been still working harder than what is considered normal.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have to help anybody, but it's just a lot of, like, extra packages coming in still from the holidays, people returning
stuff.
Well,
you keep complaining about having to split routes.
Well, no, subs do.
You said that regulars had to split routes.
Well, my day off they did.
Oh, okay.
I don't know.
I know there was one day that you thought you were going to have to split her out, and then you didn't end up having to split her out, and then you said that we already have to split her out for the next day or whatever, and so.
Yeah, subs mostly run it, which is still ridiculous to me, because we have, like, several people that have COVID in our office, and it sucks for them, I'm sure.
Yeah. So. Sorry, Eric, if you're listening.
Get better, buddy. So let's wrap this up. If you have any stories or requests of anything you want to hear about, or if you know anyone who does, please email us at afraidishpodcast@gmail.com, Instagram and Facebook at afraidishpodcast. I think I'm going to just take my Twitter down because I never use it.
Fucking, I hate Twitter so much. I hate it so much.
Yeah. Visit the website at afraid-ishpodcast.com, which I need to update because it's been a while since I've been on it.
Yeah.
All the links will be in the show notes. Also, update, Spotify now has a rating system.
Whoop whoop!
So go rate me on Spotify and iTunes. Bless you.
Thank you. I said one of these days I'm going to excise that demon for good.
It's never leaving. All right. And as always, don't be afraid of the dark.
Be afraid-ish of what's in it.
Bye.
Good night.
See you next time.
Bye.